บุตังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามDhammapada verse 163 says, "It is easy to do that which is of no real benefit to oneself. It is difficult indeed to do that which is truly beneficial and good." The traditional story that provides the contextfor where it's said that the Buddha gave this short teaching, talks about how the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, was up to all sorts of very serious misconduct and caused a huge amount of trouble. I think we can trust that the principle encoded in this short verse translates into all areas of our life, and it's for various reasons it's really worth considering, worth thinking about. It's easy to do that which is of no real benefit to oneself. It's difficult indeed to do that which is truly beneficial and good. One reason why that is a useful teaching to bear in heart, bear in mind, is because when we're having a really difficult time, we can see it constructively. Earlier today I was talking with some of the people who were on the winter retreat with us here that we're finishing today, and some were understandably, predictably talking about the challenges and difficulties they had. If we automatically assume that because we're having a hard time that something's going wrong, that's a great pity. Because all of us, obviously by this stage of life, will know to some degree that there's a lot to be learnt from engaging the difficulties of life. So just that much alone can be helpful. It's difficult indeed to do that which is truly beneficial and good. And setting out on this journey, this spiritual journey, we may be inspired in the beginning with very positive aspirations and hopes for something profoundly beautiful and wonderful. As described by those who've travelled far on the journey, though when we really give ourselves into the journey, it doesn't quite work out like that. Often it's excruciatingly difficult, intensely threatening. So the Buddha's pointing out that it's difficult indeed to do that which is truly beneficial and good can be very helpful. As for that which is easy, well, it's easy to eat yummy junk food. However, it's not going to do us a lot of good. Determining to get up in the morning and sit at a certain time, it's easy to just roll over and go to sleep, and it can feel really good. It's easy and it can feel really good. Does that mean it is good? Mm-hmm. Or somebody is annoying us and we just want to tell them what we think. And that can be the easiest thing, to just blast them and tell them, do you want to know what I think about you? That's really easy. Mm-hmm. Another good thing about this verse is it can help us understand the predicament that we find ourselves in the outer world, and look at what's going on. So much affluence now. Something like 1 in 8 people is now suffering from obesity, or at least being overweight. There's still people dying from starvation, and yet there's 1 in 8 people are obese. So much food being produced, so much clothing, so much information readily available. And despite all of that, ease of access to information has never been easier. I don't know how many times in a day I pick up my phone and do a Google search on something. It's just great. It used to be you have to go down to the library or something and wait till the library opens and look up and find where's this book, and maybe somebody else has got it and you've got to wait for a month before they bring it back and to get this information. I mean, it's hardly imaginable these days, and the ease of access to information. Does all this ease and convenience deliver contentment? And the evidence is really that it doesn't. There's an enormous amount of discontentment. And talk about global stresses these days, and the ecological stressor, the heedlessness that means that we're making a mess of the planet, and political stresses, the wars that are going on, technology, the power now that there is available, actually is producing a lot of stress. And then there's another stressor which is worth considering, and that is the stressor of being identified with the deluded sense of self. It's very easy to follow my way. How many times have we caught ourselves, I want this, I don't want that. That's my way, and it's easy. And if we want to do something about this, if we get interested in this, and certainly the Buddha encourages us to get interested in this my way, in this I, what is it? Is it safe to really invest in it? Is it really safe? Is it reliable? He didn't merely philosophize about it and saying there's no self. He provided impressive arguments in support of investigating this apparent reality of there being a solid, substantial sense of self. Look into this I. Is this feeling that I'm having, this feeling of restlessness, is this who I am? Is this really mine? And if this really was who I am, how come I can know it? How come I can hear the thoughts about it? How come I can feel in relationship to this perception of restlessness? If it's mine, how come it's not always there? Disappears sometimes. Well, feeling of gladness, if this feeling of gladness, of relief, something joyous happens and we have a wonderful feeling of relief, and if we believe in this perception of this is who I am, this is mine, if we believe in that, then probably this part of us thinks it's going to last forever. However, the evidence is, there's no doubt about it, it doesn't last forever for most of us, and maybe a few people around who've realized self-existent, unshakable well-being. For the rest of us, that's definitely not the case. So this deluded sense of I, this is, I would say, it's the number one stressor in the world of all the difficulties that human beings are having to deal with. Unfortunately, not many people seem to be really interested in it. Though, thankfully, the Buddha did encourage us to be interested in it. It's difficult to go against this sense of I. Again, another verse from the Dhammapada. It's easier to conquer 1,000 times 1,000 men in battle on your own than it is to conquer the deluded sense of self, or words to that effect. And of course, the Buddha wasn't saying anything in support of going into battle. He was using it as an example for the challenge of addressing this so often utterly convincing perception that throws us out of balance. Like the stressor of the wars that are going on. What's that all about? This is mine. I am entitled to take your land. It belongs to me. Or hatred. The hatred that exists between people. This anger that I feel towards you. This is who I am. This is mine. If we believe in that, then we become it. That's my identity. That's my source of security. And that's the danger. So again, although it's difficult to do, encouraged to develop our faculties, our spiritual faculties, so as to be able to read this phenomenon, to read this data, to analyze this data, these perceptions that we have, these impressions that we have in our minds, in our heart, this sense of self, this sense of I that we take so seriously. Seems to me pretty obvious that a major morphing has taken place over the last few decades regarding the sense of self, this I formation. See the way that people so often talk about how proud I am of myself. The word pride and being proud is used so often without any hesitation. And it seems to me that it's not being used with appreciation of self-respect or self-caring. Rather, it's almost or bordering on sometimes self-adoration. And the same applies with taking selfies. I've been around for over 7 decades now, and I can think back to a time when taking a selfie would have been considered as vulgar. And now, people might say, oh, well, that was because you were conditioned by some primitive religious beliefs, and now we've moved on from that, and now we realize that we have to promote ourselves, we have to nourish the self. Well, the Buddha also encouraged taking care of the sense of self, taking responsibility for the sense of self. However, if we're not very careful, this sense of self can become an intoxicant. So although it's difficult to turn the attention around and gently, carefully, skillfully inquire into who is this that thinks they own this feeling they're having right now? What is it that knows these thoughts that I am having? What is it that knows it? If there wasn't knowing, then it would be completely identified with it, completely lost in it. We wouldn't even be able to have this conversation, a thought or a feeling. If it really was who I am, it's like your hand. If you put your hand out in front of you, you can say, this is my hand. Well, to some degree, it is my hand. What happens if I have an accident and I cut my hand off? Do I disappear? No. It's only relatively mine. And it can't be me because I'm here looking at it. Now these considerations are very obvious. And one would think that they would attract attention of human beings. Everybody should be questioning this stuff. What is this that knows? Who am I, really? Am I the way it appears? With all the psychological data there is around these days, it's easy to come to an appreciation of the fact that there isn't a sense of I when we're born. You know, a child looks into a mirror and thinks it's something else or somebody else, and you know, just like an animal does. And most animals anyway, they look into a mirror and they think it's another animal. They don't have the mental formations that means they can process this data in a way to appreciate that it's a reflection of themselves, and up until a certain age, children can't do that either. There isn't that sense of self, that sense of individuality. It develops, it takes several years. And then what happens? Then it takes over. I become the center of everything. I am the most important thing. For much of human history, there's been a way of addressing the risk of self-infatuation. That's called religion. That's what most of, or much of, what conventional religion is about. It's about protecting human beings becoming self-inflated, self-obsessed. If we don't have a way of instilling what's traditionally referred to as virtues, you know, like humility, like modesty, like patience, like forgiveness, like generosity, like truthfulness, like compassion. If there isn't an education with regards to these principles, then there is a very real risk that this phenomenon that we call the self-structure, the ego, the personality, becomes so attractive that we dive into it and we become it. The Greeks have a myth about this subject, and the end of the story was disastrous. Becoming self-obsessed is disastrous. So religion certainly had its place in helping protect human beings, although these days, for a variety of reasons, much of humanity has turned away from religion. It's understandable, I would suggest, because under the light of scientific scrutiny, the narrative of a lot of what religions were saying doesn't hold up. Mere belief systems are not enough. Believing, for instance, that somebody is looking after you makes you feel good. Believing that you're accountable to somebody else's judgment helps make you behave yourself. However, when you get a little scientific education and you start to question everything, then that undermines this process of blindly believing, and it weakens that momentum. Is not inclined to believe in that narrative anymore. So what do we do about it? Well, there are alternatives, and you don't have to believe that somebody else is looking after us to have faith in true principles. There is a path of practice laid out by the Buddha, the Eightfold Path, and identifying these true principles, that if we apply our intelligence and investigate, maybe there's a chance, there's a very good chance, they will come to see, yes, this is worth trusting in. These principles, this Dhamma, is worth trusting in. And it doesn't depend on being intimidated by belief that somebody else is going to punish you. You can look at it carefully, question it, invited to question it. The Eightfold Path, Sammāditti, right view. It matters that we have the right view, we have the right orientation, that we, and as explained further by the Buddha, that we invest our intention into seeing what really matters. And what really matters, for example, is the Four Noble Truths, which is that suffering is something that we're responsible for. We're doing the suffering. It's not happening to us. That's a really important principle. If we don't stop and look into that, then we can think that somebody else or something else is responsible, like our parents or our astrological configuration or the government or some other religion or some other nationality is responsible for my suffering. If you look into the Four Noble Truths, you start to see pain, yes, that could be inflicted by somebody else. If your brother comes along and pinches you, ouch, that pain has been inflicted upon you by somebody else. Do we have to suffer? Well, as a child we do, because we don't have the mental processes to be able to reflect on that. There's pain, yes, there's that sensation. However, the disagreeable feeling that arises in association with that sensation, and then our relationship to that disagreeable feeling, if it's one of clinging, what happens? That dislike turns into hatred, and if we're not careful, we don't catch it at that point, then it goes up to our head, and then we start to see the person who pinched us as an enemy, and then if we're not careful, we then act on it. Certainly we act on it mentally, and start coming with all sorts of stories about how terrible they are, and we've got to do this, and we've got to do that, and get around doing that. All of that because of what? Because of a misperception of the reality of dukkha, of suffering. Not having an education into the basic fundamental right view of existence. All beings experience pain. Awakened beings don't experience suffering. Why is that? Because they've trained their faculties in accordance with right view, sammāditti, sammāsaṅkappa, right aspiration. It matters that we have the right goals in life. If we don't aspire in the right direction, then all of our energy, our tremendous energy, can be going in an unhelpful direction. Sammāvācā, right speech. It matters that we appreciate how powerful speech is. I was brought up with sticks and stones can break your bones, but names can never hurt you. Well, I can see the point of that. However, it's not really true, because words can cause enormous damage. Verbally spoken words or written words can cause an enormous amount of disruption, disharmony, and damage. Enormous amount. So understanding this as a principle, that disciplined attention to our speech matters, really matters. Right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, sammā kammata, the actions we perform with our body. But although it's obvious, a lot of people don't really appreciate that if you don't act in ways that accord with that which is honorable, that which is suitable for human beings, if you act like an animal, for instance, just taking what you want when you want, hurting other beings just because you don't like them without any reflection. If you act like that, well then you don't have self-respect. You don't feel safe. And there's a lot of conversations going on about creating safe spaces, and again I can understand the thinking behind that. However, you can't control the world, not ultimately. There's always going to be a degree of chaos. A volcano goes off and disrupts everything for a decade. And the crops fail, airplanes don't fly, internet goes out. That's inconvenient. And we can't control volcanoes going off and earthquakes and tsunamis. These things happen. If when I don't get my way, I think it's all right just to act according to my animal instincts, well, there are consequences. So again, disciplined attention and appreciation, careful, sensitive, intelligent consideration of there are consequences to our actions. There's consequences to our speech, consequences to our actions, consequences to how we earn our livelihood. Sammā ājīva. Earning our living in a way that's balanced and responsible, not just exploiting, for instance, exploiting other beings, using other people's labor and not paying them for it properly, exploiting people, harming animals without consideration of what happens to our own hearts when you harm another living being. What happens to your heart? That's worth considering. Can you keep your heart open and kill another animal? Or hurt another animal. Sammā vāyāma, right effort. What sort of effort do we make? Remember, these are principles that the Buddha articulated out of wisdom and out of compassion, so beings didn't have to just wander around making a mess of things and causing themselves and others suffering. These true principles are really worth investing in, investing attention in. Somehow, why am I right effort? Is it just willful, driven effort so that I can get what I want when I want? That's very normal. And children experiment with that. If parents are hopefully doing their job properly, then they gently, skillfully educate the children and say, no, it doesn't work like that. There's other people on this planet. You know, like there's lots of other people like you, and they want things that are sometimes different from you. So always demanding that you get what you want when you want it just doesn't work. You need to sometimes not be assertive, not be demanding. Sometimes you need to be yielding. Sometimes you need to have make a very patient sort of effort. Patient effort is different from assertive effort. Sammasati, right mindfulness. Many people who pick up the teachings on mindfulness are already pretty seriously identified as their thinking mind. They assume that mindfulness is another technique for controlling the mental realm, and it can be a very powerful technique. However, the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness are about much more than that. Sammasati, mindfulness of the whole being. Yes, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of awareness itself, mindfulness of those true principles that pertain to liberation. Like that example where the Buddha was talking about those truths that he hasn't talked about before. There's lots of stuff that I know that I don't talk about because it doesn't pertain to liberation. He picked up a bunch of leaves off the floor of the forest and said, that which I have taught is like these leaves in my hand compared to all the leaves and all the trees in the forest. This handful of leaves is much less than all the leaves on all the trees in the forest. And so are all the truths of existence, all the dhammas, all the fascinating, scintillating truths there are around that you could be investing in. A lot of them are a waste of time. And these truths, these dhammas, these phenomena are really worth investing in. So mindfulness of these dhammas, these true principles, mindfulness of awareness itself, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the body, embodied sati and sammasamadhi, or right collectedness, the right quality of collectedness. These principles that the Buddha articulated 2,600 years ago are, as far as he was concerned, timeless. It's not a matter of, well, this was fashionable in India then, and they don't really apply anymore. These teachings the Buddha encouraged us to look into any time, any place, consistently, familiarizing ourselves with the principles, mentally and internalizing them and applying them. Sometimes I entertain the fantasy that in schools they're going to, maybe before too long, introduce a course in consciousness studies which involves initially the discipline of attention, just to help children understand that you don't have to be a victim. Just because your attention is being pulled this way and that way doesn't mean to say you have to follow it. There is a choice. That's a really important lesson to teach kids. You don't have to have your attention pulled out by the sights and smells and tastes and touches and so on. And then introduce them to the possibility that you don't have to be pulled into following the mental proliferations, like the stories that you've got going on in your head, like because this person said something that's hurtful, and you've got a story going on in your head. Now, that's just your way of coming to terms with it. You don't have to be defined by it. You don't have to be pulled into that story. That's a really powerful thing to teach children. And then not just attention training, also training in understanding pain. the pursuit of happiness, it's understandable that people want to pursue happiness, very understandable. However, look at the consequences of most of the world pursuing happiness. It's thrown us out of balance. It doesn't mean to say we're all bad or mad. It's just that it's thrown us out of balance. It means that when there's a message coming through loud and clear, that is the message of suffering, we really, really ought to be turning our attention towards it. This very feeling that I have of disappointment, this very feeling, where do I feel it? Teaching children, you know, this is not believing in some external authority or agent or club, and nobody has ownership of these truths. These are just like the laws around matter. There are certain laws that pertain to the material world. There are laws that pertain to consciousness. And so helping kids understand this, and there are laws that pertain to this. And if we don't pay attention, for instance, to how we exercise attention, how we apply attention, and how we react to pain, whether it's mental pain, emotional pain, physical pain, relational pain, outer pain in the world. If we don't pay attention to this, then we're not getting the information. Consistently following, hoping that another treat is going to solve things for us, it's just going to throw us more out of balance. So, being identified as this deluded sense of self, I would say, is the number one stressor on the planet. Yes, there are serious ecological concerns that we should be paying attention to, and yes, technology and all its power, there are grounds for concern. However, if we don't pay attention to the way we relate to this perception, this felt perception of I, of mine, then things might continue to go out of balance. Thank you for your attention.